The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. That is Piano Trio in G minor, Opus 17, composed by Schumann in 1846. No, not Robert Schumann, but the less celebrated musician and composer, Clara Wieck Schumann, Robert's wife. While Clara's name may ring a faint bell for some, there are countless other female composers who have remained in obscurity for centuries. Cultural historian Anna Beer wrote about eight of them in her book Sounds and Sweet Airs, The Forgotten Women of Classical Music. Anna Beer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your book covers four centuries of female composers in Western Europe. Were there many female composers 400 years ago?
There were more than you might think there were, and certain communities allowed individuals to flourish in particular ways. And 400 years ago, one of the most important arenas for women making music was, of course, the convent, the nunnery, but equally the courts of the great leaders of Europe. They needed musicians. And if you were a musician in those days, very often, not only were you a virtuoso performer, but you wrote music that only you could perform. And so it gave a kind of opening to a handful of women.
One of those who did break through, Francesca Caccini. She was hired as a musician and composer for the de' Medici family in Florence. How did she get that position?
Well, it did help that she was the daughter of two musicians and her father was Giulio Caccini, a leading figure in the musical world of that time. But nevertheless, she clearly had something about her, and she was also in the right place at the right time, because there were two female rulers controlling the Tuscan estate at that time, the Medicis, because one man had died or was sick and another boy was too young to take control. So you've got two very powerful women in command, and they need a soundtrack to justify their monstrous rule, as it were, to justify their being in power as women. And they turned to Francesca Caccini to provide that soundtrack, and they employed her. She was the highest paid musician at the Medici court, and she was remarkable, just churning out high quality music week in, week out. They actually, in her job description, she was la musica, the music, and I quite like that.
Well, let's hear just a bit of her work. This is Lasciatemi Qui Solo. Such an elevated role in the court, why isn't her name more familiar to us?
That is the question that haunts my book. I was amongst those people who didn't really recognize the wealth of music that had been created by female composers over the centuries. And I've been trying to work out why they have been forgotten on the whole. In the earlier period, it is partly about how you create a legacy for yourself as a composer. Because if you think about it, Shakespeare didn't bother to put his plays, you know, in a folio edition. His friend, Ben Jonson, did so after his death. Without Ben Jonson collecting those works together, we wouldn't have the legacy that is the wonderful legacy of Shakespeare. So Caccini, only two works of hers were published during her lifetime, and that's all we have now. So that's one reason she's forgotten. The other is, at that time, and for centuries afterwards, so much music, all music was new music. It was about improvisation, about performance, about collaboration, about putting on a show. Why keep a record of these things? Her male contemporaries, however, were able to slot in, as it were, to systems, organisations, the church, for example, that would ensure their legacy. And that is why we still hear their music. Oh, and I should say straightforward sexism is another reason. Hmm. Each century has a way of saying in their own particular way, women are not as good as men, they can't produce music that's as good as men, and if by some freak of nature they have produced it, well, it was one off and let's sweep her back under the carpet.
So Francesca Caccini, she was a dutiful wife and mother and still composing. Then we have, let's say, a woman who made other life choices, singer and composer Barbara Strozzi. What was her path to composition?
Well, again, we've got a father or father figure who is powerful and successful, but we're now in Venice, not in Florence, and they do things differently in Venice. And music has always been part of a kind of sexual economy there. And it was the courtesans so often who were the performers and indeed writers at the time, female courtesans. So it is really, it's a Venetian phenomenon that Barbara Strozzi was brought up by her father, educated musically in order to perform at they were called academies, kind of salons for men, with a kind of crossover to providing sexual favors for those same men, the powerful men. Quite how that worked for her, very hard to tell, but we do know she had three children in her early 20s by her father or father figure's most important patron. And she learnt all her trades, as it were, in that beautiful city of Venice. What's remarkable about Strozzi is that she, in a sense, made it work for her. I don't want to make too many assumptions about how the living, breathing woman felt, but she decided to move into print. And this seems normal to us now, but she had more music in print than any other composer, male or female, mm-hmm. in the 17th century.
Well, let's hear one of her compositions. This is Lagrime Mie by Barbara Strozzi. Composition there by Barbara Strozzi, who lived from 1619 to 1677 in Venice. She is one of those who is captured in Anna Beer's book, Sound and Sweet Airs, the forgotten music of classical music. If my Italian doesn't fail me, that means my tears, and you can hear it.
It's just
an amazing composition. And there is quite a remarkable portrait of her in your book.
There is, yes.
Yes, she's clutching a viola, deep décolleté, you know, one of her breasts fully exposed. What do we get from that portrait?
I think it is almost definitely positioning her quite obviously as a courtesan and as a performer, but crucially also as a composer. There's a piece of manuscript paper there with writing on it. And you know, whatever it takes, that was her path to a life as a professional musician. As I say, who's to say that her life was any harder or indeed easier than the women of the 19th century who were completely confined to a notion of kind of being the angel in the house and domestic pleasure and the piano being the altar of the home. So one of the things that struck me as I looked at eight different women, as you say, over 400 years, is that each of them had to find a strategy to negotiate the values of their time. They were being told, this is what women do, this is what women can do, this is the kind of music you can write. And each of them found a way to either fly under the radar or to smash the radar, as it seems Strozzi did.
I understand that the working title for your book was Shadow of the Courtesan. Did Strozzi inspire that? Did you find a special sort of connection with her? What a woman.
I think she is the most obvious, the most blatant example. But in a sense, she's standing there in the bright light of being a courtesan. What is more disturbing, actually, century after century, is to see the equation whereby a woman performing and a woman composing are seen as dangerous. The voice of the woman is dangerous. It will lead men into perdition, into disaster. And that prohibition upon women's voices and upon women's creativity runs like a seam throughout the lives. And another woman in the book, Mariana von Martinez, for example, led a life of complete and utter chastity. Mm. And it still didn't help. If people wanted to attack her, the quick and dirty way to do so was to say, oh, but you know, she's had this funny relationship with so-and-so and she's not quite as pure as she looks. It's absurd, but we can still see it now. A woman, so often, particularly a powerful woman, is judged by her what we deem appropriate as her sexual behavior, by a notion of femininity. And it comes out every time. So that, for me, is the shadow of the courtesan, which hangs over all of the women in this book, right through to the 20th century.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And today we're talking about female composers of classical music whose names have largely been lost to history. Women like Mariana Martinez, an Austrian composer from the classical period, whose work you're listening to right now. It's called Overture in C. Anna Beer is with me. She's author of Sounds and Sweet Airs, The Forgotten Women of Classical Music. Anna, Martinez was a contemporary of Haydn and Mozart. How do her compositions compare with their work?
There is something about her. I hope people heard it in that little extract there. There's an energy, a wit even, about her music. And she was a great celebrity in her own time, hugely admired. We've got another very powerful female ruler, this time Maria Theresa of the Habsburg Empire, Empress Maria Theresa, who values Martinez because she can turn to her and say, look what this woman can do. Look what I can do as a ruler. And those of you who love opera, we've missed out so much because Martinez, her arias, she never wrote an opera because it wouldn't have been proper for her to write an opera. Mm. We've missed out on, I think, a great opera composer. But if you just hear her arias, you think, boy, if she'd be able to put this together, we'd be hearing this at the Met and at Covent Garden all over the world. I'm answering your question in a very long-winded way. When we say, is a composer as good as her male contemporaries? It's impossible to say because we have some music, but we also just don't know what they could have written if they'd been allowed to move into the big genres and if more of their work had survived.
Well, let's skip ahead to the 20th century, where surely conditions must improve for female composers, don't they?
Yes and no. The good news is that the two composers who I write about working in the 20th century, one from the very beginning, Lily Boulanger, and then Elizabeth McConkey, an Anglo-Irish composer from the 20th century, they had opportunities denied to their predecessors. Lily Boulanger won the major compositional prize in Paris, the Prix de Rome. Elizabeth McConkey had work performed at the London Proms. But they still run into the two problems we've really been talking about. One is the kind of need to have a properly feminine persona. And that dominated Lily Boulanger's life. She always dressed in white. She always described herself as a little girl. She was never a woman. Now, she did die horribly young, and she was ill. And so she is a tragic figure in many ways, but she was also assiduous and ambitious and really ruthless in her pursuit of the goals she set herself in her remarkably short life.
Let's hear just a bit of a composition from Lily Boulanger. This is from Psalm 130. What is the title?
From the Depths of the Abyss.
Well, that says it all.
Thank you. So she's dealing with the shadow of the Court of Thunder in one way. Elizabeth McConkie, one of the most depressing anecdotes from the time is that she was at the Royal College of Music in London, went there very young, from a very unmusical background, a real star in the making. She won every prize that you could get. But the top prize, she'd been told she'd been given it. The next day, she found out she hadn't been given it. And she went up to the leader of the Royal College of Music and said, well, what happened? I said, oh, we decided because you're a woman, you'll just get married and you'll never write another note.
Oh.
But there's a kind of happy ending to this one, or semi-happy ending. McConkie did get married, and she got married to a wonderful, wonderful man, a really supportive figure in her life. They got married in Ireland. They came back to London for this proms debut by McConkie. She was still very young. And William Lefanu is watching his wife rehearse the orchestra and what have you. And Gustav Holst, the composer, comes up to him and says, oh, jolly, jolly good. You know, keep her at it. Keep her at it, he says to the young husband. And the young husband says, I think she's perfectly capable of keeping at it herself.
Oh, bravo. Finally.
Finally. And she did. And she did. And she kept composing through astonishing challenges, nearly dying of TB. Wartime London was not kind to her or her family. She had a real struggle, but she kept composing. But still, if you go online right now and see if you can hear a live performance of one of Elizabeth McConkie's string quartets, which have been deemed by musicologists, by music critics, as some of the finest work of the 20th century, rivaling Shostakovich. Each week, you can hear 5, 10, 15 performances live of Shostakovich's quartets. I struggle to find one performance a year of McConkie, and that's worldwide.
Let's hear just a little bit from Elizabeth McConkie's string quartet number 2. The string quartet number 2, just a wonderfully vibrant composition by Elizabeth McConkie, one of many women composers who've been forgotten. Yeah. So McConkie had a supportive husband, but so did Schumann to a degree. And she, once she became a mother, you quote her in your book, I once believed that I possess creative talent, but I have given up this idea. A woman must not desire to compose. So that's a sort of reflection on one woman's self-regard. Then you have this 20th century woman, Elizabeth McConkie. How did she balance that desire to compose and her domestic life?
It's a really good question. I find McConkie inspirational because she, in fact, wrote about this. And she pointed out that if you take parenting seriously, it's not about having the babies, though for many women it might be, but it's about raising children. And at precisely the time in your life when you're attempting to achieve public recognition, when you need to travel, a lot of that energy is going into raising your children. A friend of hers, one of my favorite quotes, said that she's like a tiger inside between nursery rhymes and washing nappies. And McConkie's solution, and I have a lot of sympathy with this, was a kind of compartmentalization. When the children slept, she composed. When she was pushing the pram around, it would buy her an hour and a half to compose. To have that ability to say, yes, my children are vitally important and I want to raise them, I want to create a home for them. She loved gardening. But as soon as I can, I will snap back into my composition. That is tough. I hope we're moving into a world in which those parenting duties are shared. But certainly for the women in the book, by the 19th century, you've got a very rigid idea that the raising of children is the woman's job.
Well, Annabeer, thank you for introducing us to these fantastic composers and the beautiful music. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Annabeer, author of Sounds and Sweet Airs, The Forgotten Women of Classical Music. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Catholic saints are often depicted as pale, serene figures in settings from Middle Eastern deserts to medieval European towns. The producer Bruce Wallace brings us the story of a lesser-known saint with a very different history. Bruce traveled to the birthplace of North America's first indigenous saint to learn how she's remembered today.
The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew.
Glory to you, Lord.
In many ways, the Mass at St. Peter's Chapel is pretty typical. 15 congregants take in a gospel reading, file to the front to receive communion, then join in prayer and a hymn. But the chapel's visual cues hinted a less typical Catholic story. To the right of the altar, a painting depicts a Native American origin tale. The altar itself is draped with a rug woven in orange and red geometric patterns, and a big frame drum sits beneath it. And then, on the wall right behind the priest, a painting of an indigenous woman clasping a rosary and holding her hands in prayer. This is St. Gadadi Degaguita. The chapel is part of a shrine to her. Friar Mark Steed arrived 5 years ago to oversee it.
I was here for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden the Pope decided to canonize Blessed Gadadi. He must have heard we were fixing up the shrine. I figure that's the only reason he wanted to do it, so.
There were a few other reasons, too. We'll get to those in a bit. The shrine sits here because Degaguita was born nearby in 1656. There's a museum below the chapel and an archaeological site that some think are remains of one of Degaguita's childhood homes. After a museum tour, volunteer Helen Carpenter points me toward the site.
Go to the top of the hill, and then you have to cross the road.
Okay,
don't forget to cross the road. And be careful. Okay, the spring is over to the right. And we had Jake Finkbonner was here.
In 2006, Finkbonner, a kid in Washington State who's part Native American, recovered from a life-threatening bacteria after his supporters prayed to Degaguita. The Vatican ruled it a miracle, a major step on her road to canonization.
And he actually was reaching down into the water to kind of make contact with the person who had helped to heal him.
Much is unknown about the woman Finkbonner reached out to at this spring. Here's some of what we do know. Degaguita's mother and brother died from smallpox when she was 6 years old. The disease left her nearly blind and her face badly scarred. French missionaries set up shop in her village in 1667, and 8 years later, she joined a wave of indigenous conversion to Catholicism. Soon after, she followed that wave to an Iroquois missionary settlement near present-day Montreal. Alan Greer, a McGill University historian and Degaguita biographer, says a relationship with the French missionaries was different than you might expect.
It's not just imitating the colonizer, it's not submitting to the colonizer, it is trying to appropriate that which looks useful.
Degaguita and a group of fellow female indigenous converts discovered a Catholicism not seen from the pews, a mystical ascetic faith practiced by people with special knowledge. And that was the knowledge they wanted.
These Iroquois women were not satisfied with the role of lay people who accepted the spiritual leadership of priests. They wanted to get what the priests had and what the nuns had.
So they interviewed former patients of a nearby missionary hospital and learned about the self-depriving practices of the nuns there. Then they mimicked them, going without food and sleep, sometimes whipping themselves. Degaguita added Mohawk-inflected rituals too, including burning herself with hot coals, similar to a practice warriors used to prepare for battle.
So here we have indigenous North American women drawing on both European and Native American cultural roots to create their own spiritual practices.
Degaguita died in 1680 at the age of 24, likely a result of these hardships inflicted on a body already weakened by her earlier bout of smallpox. A Jesuit missionary who had been with her in her dying moments spent the next 15 years researching her life and promoting her as a saint.
At first, this seems like a preposterous idea, because the whole colonial enterprise, and I'm talking about, you know, Spanish, Portuguese, French, etc., is predicated on the assumption that Europeans are spiritually superior to, you know, savage heathens.
The effort languished until the late 1800s. By this time, De Guguita's roots in New York had been rediscovered, and the U.S. Catholic Church was looking for some heroes. It was a time of deep anti-Catholic sentiment, when many associated the faith with poor immigrants crowding into urban slums. De Guguita, of course, represented the opposite. In 1884, a letter to the Vatican from American church leaders set her on the long road to canonization. Not surprisingly, the indigenous people in Ganawage, the Canadian missionary settlement where De Guguita died, have mixed feelings about her. Arinda Boucher is a PhD candidate at the University of Ottawa and is writing her dissertation about De Guguita.
The few times I asked people in my community, my elders, about who she was, they rolled their eyes and said, oh, I don't want to talk about her because she's one of them. And I understood pretty early on that people saw her as a problematic figure that we had never fully dealt with.
Boucher thinks the indigenous residents of Ganawage should deal with her. In the last half century, many in her community have left the Catholic faith and started re-examining elements of native spirituality. She sees De Guguita as a guide to inhabiting both Catholic and indigenous worlds.
She never fully got away from living in the longhouse. She was adding on to it with this Catholicism. So I think that by reclaiming her narrative and reclaiming her story is part of my way of decolonizing history and trying to understand why or how we ended up in this particular situation that we're in now. She's sort of the conduit for all of that for me.
Since the canonization, Friar Mark Steed, director of the shrine in Fonda, New York, has started to think about how his Franciscans can work more fully with American Indians, both the ones that live down the road and the ones that lived up on the hill back in De Guguita's day.
We get a lot of people who come in here and they said, I don't believe what's here. There's something here I just can't put my finger on. And I said, well, if you really want to put your finger on it, go up to the dig. That's where they lived. One woman came back and she said, I had to get out of there. So I was frightened to death. She said, I felt like they were all around me. I said, they were. It's their land. They believe that those spirits are still alive, and so do we.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It started in the 1950s with Tupperware parties, but seems like the direct in-home sales model has made a smooth transition to social media. If you're on Facebook today, especially if you're a woman, chances are good that you've been invited to gobs of sales-related events, often disguised as fun excuses for girlfriend get-togethers like ladies' night or coffee date or brunch party. Maybe you've thrown one yourself, since roughly 1 in 7 U.S. households have somebody involved with direct sales. The official name for this type of business structure is multi-level marketing, and it is bigger than ever, for better or for worse. Kate Shelnut wrote about the sustained popularity of multi-level marketing among women for Vox.com. She's also associate editor of Christianity Today. And Kate, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we read about girls' night in, coffee dates, brunch parties. What is the typical setup for these home sale parties?
Like you said, they could be a number of different kind of themes or setups depending on what kind of product that you're having. So I've gone to parties where women have had brunches and told me about essential oils, where they've had girls' night in themed and tried to sell me sex toys and other kinds of products like that. I've gone to afternoon hangouts where women have had necklaces or home goods, smelled candles. So there's almost every kind of company. Now I've even seen leggings and clothing as well. There's going to be an MLM, multi-level marketing equivalent, that's recruiting women to sell these products through their networks.
Oh, maybe these are more popular in the Midwest and the South than they are here in the Northeast, though we've certainly heard of many of them. How many people are involved in these kind of multi-level marketing home parties?
Well, right now it's a $34 billion industry in the U.S., and involvement does skew female. Over 90% of the home parties are thrown by women, and some companies have more than 100,000 women involved per company in selling. Like you said, socially there is more of a Midwest or Southern kind of collective friendly mentality to it. I talked to a sociologist who said that in places like the Northeast, there's more of a desire to separate kind of your personal life to your business life than there is in some of the other parts of the country.
So why so many women, do you think?
I think there are two reasons. One of them is that women are social by nature. I think women are eager, especially in the age of Facebook and Twitter, to gather with their friends in person. They love an excuse to hang out and socialize. So in some ways, like, they're made for getting together and having the kinds of parties that companies have seen as effective sales tools. On the other hand, there are women in this kind of lean-in generation that are eager to have kind of a business or an activity of their own. And especially for stay-at-home moms, or even for women who work but want to be doing something more meaningful, that this presents an opportunity that they're not getting elsewhere.
But you point out that despite the money being made at the top level, it's very difficult for somebody to make ends meet doing this kind of work. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Absolutely. So a multi-level marketing seller is going to earn a percentage of commission on what she sells and also on what she buys herself. So sometimes women will buy a lot of products, make a big order, and they get kind of a kickback on that. And then also if they recruit other people, they make money on the recruits. But a lot of times women stay to maybe just them or them and a couple of friends, and they keep getting a check every month. Maybe that check is $50, maybe it's $500, but a lot of times they're not factoring in how much effort did I put into making this money and how much time did I put into it. If you kind of parse down the math, these women are putting way more effort into making what is a small amount of money.
Well, it's that kind of setup which I think leads a lot of people to believe that these are actually pyramid schemes. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So there are legal definitions in terms of what is a Ponzi scheme or what is a pyramid scheme. And a lot of times they involve either no product being sold or only making money on recruiting and not making money on the product itself. So even outside of that, though, you're right that there's something problematic to see the amount of income that's coming in and the fact that for most of these companies, maybe 90% of their sales force is making a couple of thousand dollars a year or less, or maybe even like $500 a year or less. They're at the very lowest level of what you could see as the company pyramid.
Have your friends been trying to sell you fitness products or weight loss shakes or smelly candles? Well, if they have, they're probably tapping into a huge multi-level marketing industry that hopes to turn your friends into clients. Kate Shulnett wrote about why so many women have joined multi-level marketing companies for Vox.com. So aside from the kind of shaky economics and time and energy that goes into selling products, you point out that it can also lead to some pretty awkward social dynamics. How does that show up?
So we talked a little bit earlier about those parties that I got invited to and would go to. And in some circles where my friends from church, my friends from being a military wife, they would start to invite me to coffee or to hang out at their house. And I had to ask myself, okay, do they really want to be my friend, or are they trying to sell me a product or get me in on their team to start selling products with them? So it starts to make you question your relationships and to kind of resent what could be very good-hearted efforts by your friends to make money, to pursue a passion, and you just kind of get an icky feeling about it.
Yeah, and also the kind of language that people start to use almost takes on this cultish aspect.
Yeah, and I wrote about multi-level marketing companies for Christianity Today, before I wrote this piece for Vox, and one of the reasons is because I think they mirror this language of purpose and meaning and depth and mission that we also see in religious organizations. And it's not a coincidence because a number of the founders of these organizations are religiously motivated. And that dates back to Mary Kay and Amway, which are companies that some older people might recognize as being some of the initial wave of multi-level marketing in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Those had Christian founders. And then today, 31 Gifts, that group is founded, not only founded by a Christian, but named for a Bible verse, Proverbs 31, which references women at work.
You mentioned women sort of leaning in. I'm wondering if you could go a little bit more deep with that and tell us, why do you think women get, I guess, sucked up into this kind of sales force?
I think that today's women are more educated and ambitious than ever. They want to be working. And for many different reasons, they find themselves in a position where either the work that they're doing at the office isn't fulfilling for them. They're not excited about it. And we see these reports about women who aren't recognized or encouraged to leadership as much as men. They're not mentored in their offices as much as men. And here come these really robust networks of ambitious women who are saying, I'm going to invest in you. I'm going to believe in you. I want you to set goals. I want you to succeed. And I think there is a genuine motivation there, but there's also a financial motivation from anyone who's recruiting someone to get involved, right? But the MLM structure is built for training up women and rewarding them in a way that the workplace isn't. Additionally, we have a ton of stay-at-home moms who have opted out of work, maybe forced down or chose not to, that this becomes a way for them to get back into that rhythm that they might really miss.
Ironic, isn't it, in some ways, that the solution that began as Tupperware parties in the 1950s, I guess, is still working for so many women.
Yeah, it's kind of a full circle turnaround the ambitious housewife, the woman who does it all, and I think that it's going to be interesting going forward to see whether or not people are going to learn from the success of multi-level marketing or pay attention to it to see what are these deeper motivations for women and how can we be tapping them beyond what's a niche industry.
Well, Kate Shelnut, thank you very much for speaking with us about this.
Thanks so much.
Kate Shelnut, we found her article on the popularity of multi-level marketing among women for Vox.com. She's also associate editor of Christianity Today. You'll find links to read the articles at wordofmouthradio.org. Changing almost as rapidly as the sales pitches on your social media feeds, food trends. Last fall, bone broth was a thing, steaming up food and diet blogs and seasonal menus and the titles of multiple cookbooks. Before that, it was kale in everything and unexpected spins on poutine. Now the culinary darlings are Hawaiian poke bowls and raindrop cakes. Well, despite being popular in foodie circles and aspirational websites, average Americans make none of the above on a regular basis. To find out what America really eats, you have to look at allrecipes.com. That's what Nicholas Hune Brown found and wrote about for Slate. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So in this sea of online recipe aggregators, AllRecipes is the most popular. How popular?
It's incredibly popular. It's the most popular English language food website in the world. Last December, December is usually the biggest month for food websites because I guess people are making Christmas dinner. It got almost 50 million visits, which is the biggest month by any food website ever.
So what are some of the most popular dishes on AllRecipes?
There's stuff like baked ziti. There is world's best lasagna has been the number one recipe, or close to the number one recipe for, I think, something like 15 years. There are a lot of dishes that use sour cream. There are a lot of baked goods, sugar cookies, pancakes, things like that. Kind of what, I don't know what you would describe it, sort of regular food.
Homey dishes, it sounds like.
Homey dishes, yeah, exactly.
Did you try to make any?
I did, yeah, I made a few. I made the lasagna, first of all. That's just kind of how I thought about this article in the first place. And then I made a broccoli casserole, which required one can of cream of mushroom soup and a bunch of cheese. And it was, yeah, it was pretty good. I made some slow cooker pulled chicken. Yeah, I made a few things.
I think I'm stuck on cream of mushroom soup. I mean, this was the base for mounds of casseroles that my mother made. So that doesn't sound like something, I don't know, a contemporary dish. How does All Recipes compare with other recipe aggregators? Like, I'm thinking Epicurious or Yumly, you know, that foodies love.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing you notice from looking at the Hall of Fame recipes is that they seem a little old-fashioned. They seem like stuff that I remember from the 80s, certainly, despite the fact that if you're online or if you're looking at different recipe aggregators, it feels like trends are pinging around quickly. In fact, you know, the things we eat, it changes a bit slower. We still kind of like the dishes that our mom made, and we eat the stuff that we enjoyed as kids. So it's a good reminder that trends don't move quite as quickly as you might think.
I was surprised to read in your article that they don't use French words like sauté.
Yeah, I mean, they try to keep things simple. They say stir instead of sauté.
No exotic ingredients. But your article is about this wide gap between how foodie circles in media talk about food compared with how people really eat. Do you think this is a rejection of that kind of dominant foodie culture? Or is something else at play?
I don't think it's a rejection at all. I think it's just kind of an indication of how far away from, you know, the reality of how we live some of the foodie culture and kind of online commentary can get. And that's, you know, it's not a huge indictment of that. You can't just keep writing articles about, hey, everyone's still eating casseroles and everyone still loves roasts. You need something new. It's kind of the nature of the news cycle. But it's a good to remember every once in a while that, yeah, not everyone is making Hawaiian poke bowls or, you know, whatever it is.
Does All Recipes embrace any food trends?
I spoke to someone at All Recipes, and she says that things are slowly changing beneath the surface. Maybe they don't show up on the, you know, top 10 lists of the site, but people are making things with more fresh fruit and vegetables. There's more so-called ethnic cuisine that people are trying. And the thing she did mention as well was that, you know, last year I remember a million food articles about cauliflower being this trendy food. And she says, in fact, that on All Recipes, just below the surface, you can see cauliflower, you know, slowly working its way up the ranks.
Nicholas, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nicholas Hune-Brown, he's a Toronto-based journalist, and we found his article, If You Are What You Eat, America is All Recipes, at slate.com. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. That's all we have time for today. I'm off to prep for an interview with Richard Russo tonight at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. Russo won a Pulitzer Prize for his novel Empire Falls, but many people know him best as author of Nobody's Fool, which was adapted into a movie with Paul Newman playing Donald Sully Sullivan, who spends much of his time as the cock of the walk in a dive bar in a fading factory town called North Bath, New York.
I think I'm getting too old for this job.
How come?
You're starting to look good to me.
I do that. I grow on people.
Russo's new novel is called Everybody's Fool, and it returns to North Bath and its hapless characters, small town folks that you cannot help but love. There's still tickets for the event tonight. You can find details at wordofmouthradio.org. And our thanks to Gibson's Bookstore for bringing this beloved writer to town. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hope to see you there. This is NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.